I'm Brian Ellison, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If you didn't know, Missouri's presidential primary is tomorrow. Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, and their teams have been hard at work in the Show Me State this weekend in what still seems to be a competitive Democratic race. Today, our politics panel discusses how we've gotten here and what tomorrow's results could bring. Later, we get an intimate look at the life of jazz icon Dexter Gordon. His widow, jazz historian Maxine Gordon, joins us to talk about her late husband's legacy. But first, how the new coronavirus is affecting Kansas City's most vulnerable populations. And we'll get doctors' tips for keeping your family safe. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. The Democratic race to see who will face President Donald Trump in November's election is approaching a decisive moment. That moment might just happen tomorrow here in Missouri. We'll talk with our politics panel about what they're seeing and what they're expecting. But first, the news on everyone's mind in Kansas City this morning is probably not politics. It's their health. Both Kansas and Missouri announced their first positive tests for COVID-19, the disease caused by the new coronavirus, over the weekend. University of Kansas Hospital has a press conference scheduled in about an hour. They're reporting that they have admitted a patient with COVID-19. We're starting today by talking about what the arrival of the virus here in the metro does and does not mean for some of the area's most vulnerable populations, including the old and the young. Let's start with the young. Dr. Dina Hubbard is a neonatologist at Truman Medical Center, and she's also a professor of pediatrics at UMKC. Dr. Hubbard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So let's start with some basics here. How vulnerable are children to the virus? Are they more or less vulnerable than adults?
Fortunately, they are less vulnerable. And for the general American pediatric public that are unlikely to be exposed to the virus at this time, the immediate health risk from COVID-19 is really considerably low.
And yet, there are certain things that kids do that might put them at some risk, right?
Absolutely. I think all children, we need to teach them, regardless of COVID-19, to be germ busters. So that includes good hand hygiene, and I think that's a good thing that's coming out of this is everyone's really focusing on washing their hands for 20 seconds, soap and water, preferably a hand sanitizer if that's not available, but for a good 20 seconds. Covering our cough and our sneeze. I know my daughter in elementary school was taught to cough into her elbow or to sneeze into her shirt. Covering cough and sneezes are good. And then avoiding touching the eyes, nose, mouth. In addition to staying home when we're sick and avoiding others who are sick, that's common advice that I give to families taking home a newborn.
Now, of course, it's easy to say that. I have become conscious during this these last couple of weeks of just how often I, as a fully grown adult, touch my face, even though I know I'm not supposed to. That must be incredibly difficult to teach kids not to do.
It really is. I think just they do what they see us doing. So I think it's an opportunity to model good behavior, and really the hand hygiene is really huge, and before and after meals and restroom breaks, and just having a discussion about it. We certainly don't want children to be fearful of this. They are hearing a lot about this on the news, so I think it's important to have the discussion. One, let kids know that they are safe, reassure them they're safe, give them age-appropriate facts, and correct any misinformation they may be hearing on the school ground, and then just encouraging them to do what they can to be germ busters.
Well, we certainly want to not add to any sense of panic, and we want to note, as you just did, that kids are in many ways less vulnerable given their immune systems. At the same time, you know, you hear these cases. When the first case reported in Missouri over the weekend was of a young woman in the St. Louis area who returned from travel abroad, tested positive for the virus, went home and self-isolated like she was supposed to, and then her father and younger sister went to a father-daughter dance at her school. What's your reaction to that story as a pediatrician?
One thing I think it's really important to understand in midst of COVID-19 is that you are much more likely to require medical attention, hospitalization, serious illness related to regular influenza.
Which comes around every year.
Right. And this year is especially high incidence of influenza. We've had over 34 million Americans that have been sickened with the flu. Over 20,000 have died, 136 of those being children. So I think it's an opportunity to really learn that, one, while COVID-19 is a new virus, a novel virus, we're facing influenza every day. And so things that we can do, like getting a flu shot, which, while it may not be perfect, it does offer protection. We've learned that from H1N1. In fact, when H1N1 was an issue in 2009, everyone was concerned similarly, and now that's included into our vaccine. There may be a potential that COVID-19 can be included in the influenza vaccine in coming years. That's certainly not a fast process. But so I would recognize that influenza is a much greater threat than COVID-19. And then also we do need to have common sense. And if you're exposed, limiting your gatherings or using good common sense,
right,
and not exposing others that may be more vulnerable, being the elderly, and then really our infant population.
And we'll talk about the elderly in just a moment. But you mentioned the infant population. We've been talking most about maybe school-age kids here. But what are special precautions that families who have infants might want to consider taking?
I'm so glad you asked, because every baby that I discharge from either the well baby nursery or the neonatal intensive care unit, I see hand hygiene. That's your number one best protection. Good hand hygiene, avoiding people that are sick. And so for babies, because they are not fully vaccinated against these vaccine-preventable illnesses, they depend on others around them. So if you have a newborn, make sure that all the close family contacts are up to date on influenza and pertussis, especially those vaccines, and older children, obviously, everyone else should be up to date on their vaccines, monitoring for fever, which is a symptom of COVID-19, but as very familiar with all, very common in all respiratory illnesses. And then for newborns, also being really selfish and holding on to them. If you are in the grocery store or a place of worship, you know, everyone's very well-intentioned and wants to see the beautiful new baby.
Right.
But really keeping them close and asking people to wave from afar.
That's Dina Hubbard. She's a neonatologist with Truman Medical Center. Let me turn now to a colleague of hers at the Truman Medical Center, Dr. Gary Salzman, who is a pulmonary disease and critical care specialist, also a professor at UMKC2. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Salzman, I know you work with patients of various ages and situations, but older populations, as Dr. Hubbard mentioned, are considered more vulnerable. Why is that?
Sure. Well, older people generally have chronic diseases. As you get older, also your immune system tends to wane, and so you're not as good as fighting off infections. And so older people need to take special precautions and think about it. And then it's not just an age thing. It's how healthy you are. So you may have people that may be younger in their 40s or 50s but have diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, they may be at higher risk for getting very sick as opposed to a healthy 60 or 70-year-old person that doesn't have any chronic disease. So it's not just the age, it's also the underlying health problems.
Do people generally know if they're in a high-risk category, or are there people who are more vulnerable walking around without actually knowing that?
I think most people know that they're sick, you know, that they may have cancer and they're on chemotherapy, they know they have a bad heart disease and take a lot of medicine. So I think most people know that they have chronic diseases by the number of medicines they're taking. And I think that, you know, they would already know that. But then, you know, the problem is that if they did get this virus, they could get much sicker than somebody that doesn't have these chronic diseases.
We heard from Dr. Hubbard about the importance of hand hygiene. We've been hearing a lot about 20-second hand washing, the songs you can sing to make sure you're washing your hands for 20 seconds. What other tips are you giving folks, especially older patients, to be mindful of in these days?
Sure. So if you're older and you have chronic diseases, obviously if you're sick, stay home and don't go out, and then try to avoid being around other sick people. And then, you know, try to limit your exposure to large groups of people. And I think that's, you know, that's common sense type of thing. You don't want to be in large groups because your risk of getting infection would be higher the more people that you're exposed to. But then, of course, the hand washing and, yeah, and those tend to staying away from other people that are sick.
I mean, and would you say that in all cases with patients who are in these vulnerable groups, whether there's been reports of diagnosis or not, whether there's sick people around or not, just avoid all large gatherings of people?
I mean, I think you have to, you know, have to be reasonable. I mean, obviously, if you're having families having a big birthday party and you're going to get together with family, you know, you don't want to miss that. And, you know, again, it depends on how sick you are, how many problems that you have. I mean, people are talking about not going to church or not going to sporting events. But again, I mean, a healthy 70-year-old probably has a lower chance of being very sick than someone that has multiple chronic diseases in their 50s. So it again, is common sense, and depending on how many chronic diseases you have. And then also, you know, the importance or the, you know, the, you know, why you wanted to do that event. And so I think that all those things go into each patient having to know what risk they have and then deciding how much risk they want to take.
We've only heard of the one positive case we should be clear about here in the Kansas City area. That was in Johnson County. Are you seeing an increase, though, in inquiries? Are people worried about this in your neck of the woods?
Yes, we're getting a lot of phone calls of people that are worried, particularly about travel. You know, should I cancel my air flight? Should I cancel my cruise? And what we're trying to do is to give them the risk assessment. If they're at extreme age, over 80, if they have chronic medical conditions, then we are telling them to consider not traveling on an airplane or cruise ship. Again, if they're working and they're in their 60s and 70s and otherwise healthy with no chronic medical conditions, then the risk of getting very sick from the virus would be much lower. And so we're trying to give them that risk assessment and then have the patients themselves decide whether they want to cancel their cruise or cancel mm-hmm. their flight.
Give us a practical threshold. And I know it's hard to say this, to give medical advice to nameless strangers over the radio, but you know, the first time you cough maybe isn't when you need to call the doctor. The first little sniffle you're feeling, but when is the right time to actually get yourself checked out?
You know, you should have a thermometer and take your temperature. I think the temperature is a really good kind of differentiation. If you've got kind of the sniffles and kind of a routine cough, you're probably not going to develop a fever. But if you take your temperature and you have a fever, and a fever we think about is 100.4 or greater, and you have a cough that's been going on, and then also if you have trouble breathing. So trouble breathing, cough, and a fever, that'd be a reason to contact your healthcare provider and query about whether this is something serious. But, you know, kind of a routine cough without fever, no shortness of breath, probably not of concern.
And if you do call the doctor, what would a patient expect to hear? What are they going to say if I call Truman Medical Center and say, I think I might have this?
Yeah, we're going to ask about their symptoms. Shortness of breath is a big one if it's associated with a cough. And then fever is a big one. If they've got a significant fever, 101, 102, we would be more concerned. And then, of course, their travel history. If they've gone to places that are endemic, to China, South Korea, you know, those kind of places, Italy, Iran, mm-hmm. you know, those would be real red flags. But even Japan also is on that list. So travel history, you know, it would be important. But I think still we're having, you know, very few cases in Kansas City. So I think the risk is still relatively low, at least right now. But this obviously is a changing landscape.
You want me to call before I come and not just show up at the hospital?
Yes, we want to get ready for you. Right. I was just talking to this today with our nurses. So if we do have a person come in, we're going to have them come in through a special door. We'll have a mask for them. We'll put them immediately in the room. We won't have them sit in the waiting room with the other patients if we're suspecting they have this virus.
That's Dr. Gary Salzman. Earlier we talked to Dr. Dina Hubbard, both from Truman Medical Center, about some of the vulnerable populations in our community as the threat of the new coronavirus makes its way to our metro. Dr. Salzman, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Well, we're one day from Election Day in Missouri, and this week leading up to tomorrow's presidential preference primary might have been the most attention the Show Me State will get from those seeking the White House this year. As we pull into the home stretch, we've invited our politics panel back to talk about the long, winding road that has brought us here and what we should be looking for in tomorrow's results. Eric Wesson is managing editor of The Call. Eric, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And also Beth Vanami. She's the interim associate dean and chair and associate professor of political science at UMKC. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
It's nice to have you back. And thank we're also you. Joined from Jefferson City by Brian Houseworth, who's news director of MissouriNet. Brian, good to talk with you.
Good morning, Brian. Appreciate you inviting me.
So both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have been in the state. Bernie Sanders is in St. Louis right now. Dr. Jill Biden is speaking in Kansas City at this hour. Let me ask all of you, how important is Missouri for what's happening tomorrow as six states go to the polls? Eric Wesson.
It's pretty important. There are 68 pledged delegates that are up for grabs. And right now in this part of the race, every delegate counts. So you can't just blow off delegates in the state. You have to actually go in and campaign in that state and ask people for their votes.
Beth Anami, is Missouri usually this important and popular come primary time?
I think it's important, especially this time around, because Sanders did so well last time, and it was basically essentially a tie between Clinton and Sanders. And so I think if he doesn't do as well as last time, I think it might be a problem for his campaign going forward.
Yeah, so actually, Brian Houseworth, it's how well Bernie Sanders did that has raised expectations possibly for tomorrow.
Well, for the first three races he won, including Iowa and New Hampshire, and there's no question about that. I agree with the professor and your other guest in that the latest poll that came out from CNN this morning has Biden with a double-digit lead over Bernie Sanders for the nomination. Of course, that's a nationwide poll. So Missouri, very important. Bernie Sanders is campaigning, as you mentioned, in St. Louis, and I thought one of the things that was interesting about his campaign, Brian, yesterday is he announced some of his Missouri supporters. And one of his most prominent supporters is a former lawmaker, state lawmaker from the Kansas City area, Brandon Ellington. Another big supporter is Rasheen Aldridge. So he has a lot of support, as you know, from some of the African-American lawmakers. Now, the question is, will it be enough in the state of Missouri? And we'll find out tomorrow.
Well, let me ask you, Eric Wesson, about that. Managing editor of The Call, which serves the African-American community here in Kansas City. Does one of these candidates have a lock on black voters in Missouri?
I would give the edge to Biden for having that edge, just basically because we've been with Bernie Sanders before, that we've been down this street. It's basically the same message. So I would say that the edge would have to go to Biden. And then Congressman Cleaver endorsed him on the other side of the state. He's getting endorsements as well. So I'm going to lean more toward Biden.
Jackson County Executive Frank White, former Kansas City Mayor
Absolutely.
Sly James, Gwen Grant of the Urban League, a lot of African-American leaders in Missouri siding with Joe Biden, which certainly was instrumental in Joe Biden's resurgence in the campaign in states like South Carolina. Beth?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think certainly and probably tomorrow, too, in Mississippi, we should see probably a pretty huge margin between Biden and Sanders in Mississippi. I assume it'll look a lot like we saw in the southern states of Alabama last week.
And our newspaper endorsed him as well, Joe Biden. So,
all right. So from The Call, there is support in the African American community here in Kansas City, at least for Joe Biden. You know, you mentioned the polls a moment ago, Brian Houseworth. There have been just a handful of polls of Missouri likely voters, and they do show Biden leading, but the range is from 4 points in one poll to 30 points in another poll. It's tough to measure primary voters sometimes. What is making it hard to gauge how Missouri will go? Why are people still thinking this is such a competitive race?
Well, I think that difference you have there between 4 and 30 really sums it up. And a lot of it, my colleague Ashley Byrd was over in Kansas City yesterday and this weekend. She was covering, obviously, Saturday as well, the interviews going on and the event with Joe Biden and Congressman Cleaver. And some of the voters she spoke to broke to Biden just in the last week or maybe 2 weeks. So that has had something to do with it as well. The other thing is sometimes people make up their minds at the end, and I expect there'll be some that won't make up their minds until they go into the voting booth tomorrow. And we don't have this very often. It's obviously once every 4 years, and in some cases we've had years where it doesn't get a lot of attention because we know who the nominee is going to be. This is a big one. I would say 16 was a big one because we had an open primary, if you will. The president was departing, so that was a big one. And then 2000 was really a big one as well. You all probably remember when George Bush, primarily on the Republican side, because Al Gore, we all knew, was going to be the Democratic nominee, but there was a big race on the Republican side between John McCain in Missouri, as well as George W. Bush, and I do remember a lot of interest on the Republican side as well. But there have been other years, not nearly as much. But this year, I think, is interesting, but again, I have no idea. We'll find out tomorrow what really happens.
You know, it is interesting that we have come to this place of this really being a two-person race. It was only a couple of weeks ago that there were a whole handful of candidates, and I think folks would have said it was still anybody's game. Eric Wesson, as you talk to folks in the community, what is their impression of their choices, of their range of choices, which have now come down to two 70-something white men who have been around the political scene for quite some time now?
I think that first the field was so crowded that people didn't know who had the best message. There was a lot of bickering going on when you watched the debates. There wasn't a clear front runner. I think the Carolina race, and even though Bernie Sanders was leading, those were caucuses. Mm-hmm. And caucuses are different than primary elections when people actually go in and check a ballot. So I think that once Joe Biden separated himself as the candidate, I think that kind of smoothed and leveled things out a little bit. But here's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
Is it enough to turn Missouri blue? Because as we know, this is pretty much a red state now. So will Biden and his policies, and will he be able to shift the momentum from being a Republican state to being a Democratic state?
And what do you think is the answer to that question?
You know, I don't know. People still like the president as wacky as some of the things he says and does sometimes. Well, people still like him.
I mean, I think that is the question, Beth Fanami. Donald Trump won just 3.5 years ago by 19 percentage points. This is a lot of interesting talk for a few days here in the Democratic primary, but is this the last competitive thing that will happen in the presidential race in 2020 in Missouri?
Possibly. I actually think how the president handles himself with the coronavirus is potentially the spot where Biden or Sanders have an opportunity to really display leadership. And I think that is the only – I don't think ideologically there's a chance for Democrats in Missouri. Mm-hmm. But I think on the leadership front, there could potentially be an opportunity.
You think there's some shakiness around Donald Trump's hold on the hearts of Missouri voters?
Well, I think there's some shakiness in terms of his management of the corona outbreak. And so I think there is an opportunity for somebody to really show leadership and to show, you know, some control over emotions and personality that I think we don't see as often from the president.
Well, this question, Brian Houseworth, about the broader impact of this race on Missouri politics writ large is something that you cover at MissouriNet. You cover the whole state's politics. Right. I'm curious, what are folks saying about the impact of this primary and the outcome of this primary, who's at the top of the Democratic ticket, on other races? This is a general election year in Missouri. Every statewide office and the whole state house and half the Senate are up for election. Does it matter whether Joe Biden or Bernie Sanders is at the top of the ticket to the state's Democrats?
Well, it really depends, and a lot of the Democratic leaders have not really taken a position up until now. Now, as you mentioned, Congressman Cleaver is an exception. He endorsed Joe Biden a long time ago, but there are many. Jay Nixon, the former governor, endorsed Michael Bloomberg, and now has endorsed Joe Biden. But I did speak to the two top Democratic leaders in the Missouri House, along with the other press members, on Thursday, and they didn't endorse. They're not making an endorsement, but they do say what Missouri brings is kind of a symbol of the rest of the country, because you have a lot of rural areas, you have the urban areas, and Crystal Quaid made the point, Brian, that in the urban areas, specifically Kansas City and St. Louis, their base, which is a lot of progressives, they have their priorities, but yet she mentioned the Democrats are trying to campaign in rural areas where voters are more conservative. And she said that's something that really symbolizes what's happening in the country for the Democratic Party. So I thought she made a very interesting point there. They did not endorse. The other thing I would point out is that for years and years, Missouri voted for the presidential winner in every election except 1956 when they voted for Adlai Stevenson. That stopped in 1996. Bill Clinton carried the state of Missouri in 1992, and he did in 1996, and of course he won the presidency. But when George W. Bush won, and George W. Bush as well, but after that, Missouri started voting for not necessarily the winner in elections. So it's not necessarily a bellwether state like it used to be. It's gotten more red over the years. And the last Democrat, as I mentioned, to win in this state was Bill Clinton, and that was 1996.
I don't want to just talk about the politics of this. I'm talking about the candidates' messages for just a moment. Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have been preaching pretty much the same sermon in every state that they've gone to. But is there something for Missouri voters that each of them particularly brings? Eric Wesson, The Call, endorsed Joe Biden. Why? What is it about his message to voters that is working, at least for the Missouri voters you're talking to?
Well, he's been able to transcend and get that support. But I think that our position was the down ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be the better candidate at the top of the ticket, him or Bernie Sanders? And unfortunately, Bernie Sanders' progressive base hadn't been showing up to vote. So that was something that we took into consideration, the down ticket. Who's going to be the better candidate? You have to defend a lot of House seats. There are some Senate seats that are going to be up for grabs. Will Joe Biden be enough to drive voters out to maybe capture some of those Senate seats?
How would you answer that question, Beth Fonami? Do you think Joe Biden can do that?
Possibly. I think if he exploits something that often people talk about as a weakness, I think if he turns it into a strength, especially against Trump, which is his sort of need for forgiveness or his over the years, he's really taken some positions on issues and whether it's busing or it's the Iraq War, that he's actually apologized for and sort of, you know, regrets those decisions. I think if he turns that into, you know, I'm a person who, you know, recognizes when I'm wrong and then tries to make it right, I think he could do well against Trump. Sanders' advantage is that he hasn't made those decisions, and so he doesn't have anything to apologize for. But I think Sanders' weakness is that the people who are most aligned with him, as Eric pointed out, young voters, haven't been showing up nearly as much as they did in 2016 when he was so competitive against Clinton. Mm-hmm. So just in the Super Tuesday contest, turnout among young people was 15 to 20% of the electorate in 2016. It's now been closer to 10% in the Super Tuesday contest. So I think there's some potential, but it's really got to happen now for Sanders.
And that could be all the difference,
right?
That kind of margin. I'm mindful, Brian Houseworth, of I saw Joe Biden campaigning in Missouri back in 2008 when he was on the vice presidential ticket with Barack Obama. And I was struck when he spoke to crowds in Liberty, when he spoke to folks in St. Joseph, of kind of his folksy, familiar way that actually seemed to really resonate with sort of these Missouri voters, not in perhaps the most populated parts of the state. I don't know. Does the candidate 12 years later have the same touch? What is your observation as you've seen these campaigns swing through the state over the past week?
Yeah, and I would add one thing. He stopped in Jefferson City right here in town at Memorial Park in 2009. Of course, the campaign was over, but he met with a lot of voters and was talking about jobs, seemed very comfortable at the time. I think he is. I mean, I wasn't at the event in Kansas City. My colleague Ashley Byrd was, but I did watch a lot of what he had to say. Seemed very comfortable. A lot of his message seems very similar to what he has said before. The question is, will it be enough for him to do well in the state of Missouri? And again, I go out into the rural areas a lot, and I do radio interviews in the rural areas. President Trump is still very popular in most of these rural areas that I go to. I was in the Boot Heel. It's been 2 years ago, but I was down there, and that 8th district, which when I was growing up was all Democratic, President Trump carried that district, Brian, by 56 points. when I grew up there, 56 points. When I grew up there, there was one Republican state representative in that Southeast Missouri district. Today, it's all Republican. So that kind of tells you how rural Missouri has flipped. That said, I think Biden's a formidable candidate, but I also think Bernie Sanders is too.
It is a different world now. We should note, of course, that it is a primary election day tomorrow for all of the parties. There will be a Republican primary. Donald Trump is on the ticket with four other candidates. And when you show up at the polls, you'll get a chance to ask for a Constitution Party ballot or a Green Party ballot. If you're feeling like your choices are too hard, you could take a Libertarian ballot because there's only one candidate there. Jacob Hornberger seems to have a lock on the nomination from Missouri. Eric Wesson, is there anything you'll especially be watching for tomorrow?
Just voter turnout. Yeah. Is it exciting enough to get people to turn out and vote? And like I said a bit earlier, there was a lot of bickering when they had all these debates, and there were a lot of people in there, and the issues would get lost with the candidates. So I think that now that you have two front runners, or two candidates, rather, whether or not that's going to be enough to excite the base to get them out to vote.
Beth Vanami, what are you watching for tomorrow?
I'm actually watching for what happens tonight with Elizabeth Warren. I'm curious if she's going to succumb to the Sanders pressure and issue an endorsement or not. I think there's potential for him to do quite well if he gets that endorsement. But then I'd look at Washington and Idaho. That's his best shot of success. And so if he doesn't do well there, I think the nomination might be wrapped up pretty quickly.
Brian Houseworth, final word?
I would say the voter turnout is the big thing I am looking for tomorrow. The Secretary of State's office doesn't make a prediction, but they do talk to the local election officials, and based on that, they're going for about a 40% turnout. Mm-hmm. You hit it on the head. People will have to declare one of the five-party ballots. The other thing I'd say very quickly, Brian, is that Secretary of State Jay Ashcroft, when I covered his budget presentation at the Missouri House in January, he did call for going away from Missouri's presidential preference primary, not this one. Obviously, it was too late. But in future presidential primaries, he said that this is an election that has, quote, really no bearing on the presidential race. He suggested going to a caucus system, saying that we spend $9.1 million a year. We haven't heard much from either party about that since. I don't expect it to be a big issue now, but that's something I'll be looking for next year to see if there's any sort of bill filed to essentially get rid of the primary.
That's Brian Houseworth of MissouriNet, Beth Vanami from UMKC, and Eric Wesson from The Call. Thanks to all of you for being here today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Brian.
When we come back, we'll switch from politics to jazz and the fascinating history of one of the genre's all-time greats, as told by his widow, Maxine Gordon. She'll be in Lawrence this weekend with a tribute to her husband, Dexter Gordon. We'll talk with her in just a minute. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And welcome back to KCUR's Up to Date. I'm Brian Ellison in for Steve Kraske. If you're missing Steve this morning, we have just the thing. Go to kcur.org/Kraske and subscribe to Kraske Off Mic. Every Monday, you'll get updates on the shows you missed and a weekly column from Steve. So sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Join us on Tuesday's show. Lenexa is reconsidering zoning regulations affecting the city's homeless shelters. Learn what homelessness advocates are saying about the proposal on Tuesday. Tenor sax being played by Dexter Gordon, one of the most celebrated jazz musicians of all time, a pioneer of bebop, known for his wide range of improvisational styles and the ways he connected with audiences. Dexter Gordon was even nominated for an Oscar. Before he died in 1990, he had planned to write a memoir of his life. He'd written quite a lot of it, but it fell to his widow, Maxine Gordon, herself an important behind-the-scenes figure in the jazz scene and a chronicler of its history, to bring that work to fruition. The story she tells is called Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon, and Maxine Gordon joins us today from NPR in New York City. Maxine, thank you so much for being with us on Up to Date.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
We should mention that Maxine will be in Lawrence this weekend for a tribute performance, Remembering Dexter and His Music. That's Saturday night at the Lawrence Arts Center main stage. Maxine, anyone who knows jazz knows Dexter Gordon. Put him in perspective for everyone else. How did his contributions shape the world of jazz?
Well, what you just played is an early example of Dexter. I think it's... It's from the 40s.
It was from 1947, called Mischievous Lady.
With Melba Liston.
That's right.
And trombone, right.
Now, Melba Liston was the mischievous lady in question. That was before
before
he met you. What was that song about? Who was she, and how did she come to get a song named for her?
Well, actually, it's a joke that she's called Mischievous Lady because she was far from mischievous. She and Dexter met in junior high, he said she could play in all the keys, she could write music, she could do. By the time they got to high school, she knew so much about music, and she used to look out for the younger guys. She was a little younger, but they called her Mama because she used to tell them, don't smoke, don't drink, you know, be on time for school. So, and their relationship lasted... Dexter died first, so their whole lives, they were friends. Mm. She went to live in Jamaica. We went there to visit her. So it was a really great relationship.
Well, that's one of the things you write about in the book. They met when they were so young. She had just moved to L.A. from Kansas City, actually.
From Kansas City, right.
And all of these very influential musicians, including Dexter, were so young when they started having this impact.
Right. Well, that was one of the things I realized writing the book, how young they are when they begin, teenagers,
mm-hmm.
you know. And then I'm working on another book where the one of the characters, or one of the people in that's not a character, a living person, Velma Middleton, she was like 12 when she's working as a dancer. So, you know, this is quite common. We forget that.
Yeah, because we think of them as the greats that they became as adults,
right.
But they were young when they started. You were involved in the world of jazz yourself, an important figure in your own right, a manager, a producer.
Maybe not important, but involved.
I'm going to say people would say you are pretty important, Maxine. And what were you doing when you first met Dexter?
I was a road manager. It's what was called road manager at the time, and it's evolved to the same job, tour manager. And then I was asked to do something that's called artist liaison, and of course that's road manager.
Mm-hmm.
But I was the road manager for a lot of groups in Europe in the 70s, and on the big jazz festivals I would do the, you know, travel hotel, payroll. That's what a road manager does.
And you were traveling all over
Dexter.
Europe, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I did by train. We used the train. In those days, they would get a Eurail pass, which meant that musicians could travel first class all over Europe, which saved money to the agent. They liked that. So I became the person with the train book. But I met Dexter in 1975. In Nancy, France, and he'd been living in Copenhagen for 14 years, and he started talking about coming back. He wanted to come home, and so then I worked with him on that. I was his manager. It evolved, and I became his wife and not his manager.
What had he been doing in Europe? Why was he in Europe through so much of the 60s and 70s and not part of the he was part of the American jazz scene, he just wasn't in America?
Well, he went in 1962, and the way he tells it, he had a two-week job at Ronnie Scott's club in London. Ronnie Scott was a saxophone player. He had a club. He invited Dexter. Dexter had never been out of the country. It was his first passport. He went, and the way Dexter tells it, I went for 2 weeks, and when I looked up, it was 14 years later. And what happened was he had so much work. And he was received as an artist. He liked that. He went to live in Copenhagen. He rode a bicycle. He bought a house. And he, he was very comfortable there, and he traveled all over Europe easily because, you know, Europe is not that big.
Yeah.
Geographically.
Well, and he played a lot, too,
he was comfortable.
Right?
All the time.
We actually have a recording of him from when he was in Copenhagen in 1967, and this clip starts with his voice telling us what he's playing.
Oh, great.
The squirrel. The squirrel.
That's Dexter Gordon playing the squirrel in Copenhagen in 1967. Maxine Gordon, that's pretty classically the Dexter Gordon sound, isn't it?
Yes, I would say. Who's on that recording with him?
Let's see. He was playing at the Montmartre in the summer of 1967.
Right.
I do not have down here who he was playing with on that particular recording, but it's from the album, the live album, The Squirrel. So he actually made a recording of that. If you listening to this, what makes it classically the Dexter Gordon sound? What should I be hearing that says, oh yeah, that's him?
Well, I mean, you need a musician to really answer the question. However, what Jimmy Heath told me was it only takes one note to know it's Dexter, because of the tone and the confidence and the humor and, you know, the range he played in. And, you know, it's not like he built up to the solo. He starts right in as Dexter. He comes in with a statement. And
yeah.
Jimmy Heath said that he and John Coltrane sat in Jimmy's mother's living room listening to Dexter, that early recordings, the one you played from that period, over and over, and they'd wear them out, and they'd have to go get another one because the 78 would wear out. And then one day they said, let's switch from alto to tenor so we can play like Dexter, because they both played alto.
Wow.
So it's in the book, but to me that's like the greatest line in the book, because I didn't know that. I mean, I don't know how many people knew that. But to hear it from Jimmy Heath, who just passed, you know, was made all the difference.
You know, we heard his voice there at the start of that clip, which a lot of musicians would say they let their instruments speak for themselves. And, of course, Dexter Gordon, a lot of people would say, spoke with his instrument everything he played. But he also was known for doing some talking at his concerts and really engaging with the audience.
And he would recite the lyrics of the ballads before he played them, which he learned from Lester Young.
And Maxine, our crack producer, Danny Alexander, has looked up who else was on that recording. The bass was
Bo
Steef, and the drums was Art Taylor.
Oh, see? Yeah, Art Taylor lived in Europe for a long period as well. Thank you. Who's on piano?
Well, we don't have that
okay,
one down. Sorry, it's all
no,
we can do.
The reason I ask is that one of the things in Dexter's book, when he was writing the notes for his own autobiography, he said, I want every musician in every band listed, because nobody ever talks about them, and they're just as important as a leader.
And that says something about him, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kenny Drew was on the piano.
Learned
that.
And he lived in Copenhagen as well.
So all these guys living in Europe through some pretty trying times for the U.S., you know, the civil rights movement, Vietnam. Was there an element of escape in them being there?
Well, there were, when that conversation came up, Dexter said, the only person I know who's truly an expatriate, when they would ask him about being black and leaving the country in the 60s, he said, the only person I know who actually is an expatriate is Red Mitchell, who's not black, who went to Sweden, who burned his draft card and was, you know, worked against the U.S. government. I mean, he spoke out against the government in the Vietnam War and about racism. And Dexter said, ironic that it would be Red Mitchell. He said, the rest of us, yes, you know, we left because the situation became unbearable. But in Dexter's case, it was he was glad that he could leave the country because he had a really bad period in the 50s where he couldn't because he was incarcerated and he was a drug user. So when he was free from that, leaving the country allowed him to play and be a musician.
Talking with Maxine Gordon. She's author of Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. She'll be in Lawrence on Saturday, as we mentioned, at the Lawrence Art Center. She'll also be at the Johnson County Community College Thursday, March 12th at noon for a conversation, and that conversation's free and open to the public. Maxine, you've researched and written about other jazz figures, other parts of the jazz world. How difficult or how different was this project, writing about someone who went on to become your husband?
Before I answer that question, can I mention that in the concerts and the conversation, the person who has sponsored all of this is the great Deborah Brown from Kansas City.
Yes, she's performing on Saturday, I know, at the Lawrence Arts Center.
And Friday, okay. And having a conversation about the book, because her experience, it relates to Dexter's, and she's very popular in Europe. She's like, you know, they dedicate festivals to her. That's how I met her, at the Amersfoort Jazz Festival, and she was the honored guest. And I was like, who is that? Because I'm very bad. And I had not been aware of her. And then when I heard her, she had this huge crowd screaming and yelling, and we talked. And she said, are you coming to Kansas City? And I was like, not yet. So I am coming to Lawrence, and she's responsible for all of this.
Very good. Well, very good. And folks will want to check out online all the different places that they can see you and see Deborah Brown this weekend. I was asking about...
But I will answer.
About what it was like to be doing this kind of work, researching your husband.
Well, it was a promise I made. We were living in Mexico. He began the book, and one day he said, well, if I don't finish it, promise to finish it. And I said, okay, no problem, before I knew what was involved. Okay. But no, it wasn't a problem.
You write in the book about how he would write so many memories down on these long yellow legal pads, and you would transcribe them, and he would edit them. And those writings make their way into this book that you've written, almost like jazz solos, sort of stepping out front and saying a few words.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's what we were trying to do. Oh, sorry. That was the idea.
One of the seasons that you go on to write about after he came back to North America was the opportunity to star in a movie, in Round Midnight, the film by the French director Bertrand Tavernier. You and your son and Dexter moved to Paris for the filming. What do you remember about that experience?
Well, actually, I remember everything about it, and I've seen the film so many times, you know, and it's been shown all over the world, even in Madagascar. And when I look at the film, I have total flashback to the making of the film, to the house we lived in, and my son went to day camp in Paris, and, you know, buying the baguette. And, you know, it's a very funny thing when I see the movie, I remember the set. I remember all the great musicians, Billy Higgins, Bobby Hutcherson, Cedar Walton, Freddie Hubbard. It's so great to see them. And, you know, it's sad because they're not here, but the way Bertrand made the movie, they're so alive. So it's all a very good memory, and I think I have a way of not remembering bad things. Mm-hmm. So,
well, it's funny because you say that was true of Dexter too. You said you said in the book that he actually didn't want you to include any bad things.
Well, you know, that's taking it to the extreme. And people ask me, oh, you know, how do you feel about including things that he didn't want in the book? And I think he knew I would include it. Even, you know, because he did say, if you want it in the book, write it your damn self. So,
and so you did.
Know, I did.
The music.
Yeah, I did talk to friends of his, and they said, put it in.
Yeah. These are some of the years before he went to Europe, even.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're listening right now, by the way, to music from the movie Round Midnight and from the 1976 album Homecoming, live at the Village Vanguard, which he played with Woody Shaw and Ronnie Matthews and Stafford James and Louis Hayes after coming back to the U.S.
Right. That was when he signed with Columbia Records. Right.
you know, I guess I wonder if how his life and maybe how your life was different after that movie came out. He was nominated for an Oscar for Best Actor in a Leading Role.
Yeah. Well, you fly first class. That's what, that's what, you know, Dexter said that was a difference. But no, I don't think life really changed for us because he wanted to get back to being a saxophone player. He was like, can we go back to our regular life?
Mm.
So, you know, the spotlight didn't impress him. So.
Yeah. After Dexter died in 1990, you kept another promise to him. You finished college, and not only did you finish college, you went ahead and got a master's degree and a doctorate.
Uh-huh.
What motivated you to do that?
Well, really it was my friend Shirley Scott. She had gone back to college, and she was teaching at Cheney University, and she... I had made that promise about finishing, and she said, oh, yeah, no, you have to finish. I mean, she was there when I graduated from college. And then, you know, what happens is I had a professor, Dr. Cooper. He said, oh, you're not done. You know, you're going to go on to graduate school. And I was like, no, I have to go to work. He said, oh, you'll get a fellowship. I'm writing the letter. So I did at NYU, and my PhD advisor was Robin Kelly, who wrote the famous book on Thelonious Monk. You know, the Monk biography,
mm-hmm.
and he's a very brilliant guy. And so, you know, life just kind of followed, you know, it's jazz, you follow the path, right?
As you mentioned a moment ago, Maxine, Deborah Brown, who's a jazz musician in Kansas City style, will sing songs from the movie Round Midnight. She'll be joined in one of those events by the Montez Coleman Trio out of St. Louis. When these concerts happen, when there are tributes made to Dexter's work, what does it mean to you to have his music remembered and replayed and reinterpreted by a new generation this way?
Yeah, this is what I really love when I'm approached about a tribute to Dexter. Like, Deborah had the idea, and she said, who would you like? I was like, that's totally up to you and the musicians in each area. Like, for his birthday, I went to Los Angeles to this fabulous place, the World Stage. They had all L.A. musicians, two tenor players, so a rhythm section, great players. So, you know... this is what Dexter would want.
That's Maxine Gordon. She's the author of Sophisticated Giant, The Life and Legacy of Dexter Gordon. That's been out for a couple of years now, but it's worth...
November 2018.
All right, so just a little more than a year. So pick it up. But also come see Maxine Gordon in conversations she's having at the Johnson County Community College and a tribute concert out at the Lawrence Arts Center this weekend. You can find all that online. Maxine Gordon, it is so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
And we're going out with more music from the soundtrack of Round Midnight, featuring none other than Dexter Gordon. On Friday, we learned about a bill to extend compassionate release time for Kansas inmates. You can hear that and other previous conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Also, find and follow us on Twitter. We're at @KCURUptodate, and I'm at @PTSBrian. Don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook, too. Join us tomorrow on the show. One educator questions why students still self-segregate decades after Brown versus Board of Education. Learn why conversations about race and identity could help bridge the divide. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Chelsea Engstrom. I'm Brian Ellison, and you are up to date.